the decline of measles antibodies in infants,
changes in life expectancy in the United States over the last almost 60 years,
a smartphone-based way to detect norovirus,
and improving our ability to diagnose or exclude blood clots in the lung.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on November 29th, 2019.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'd like to turn right to the Journal of Pediatrics. This was a study that was published last Friday, and since we record on Wednesdays, we frequently have to catch up on those particular studies. As I said, in the Journal of Pediatrics, this study took a look at 196 infant sera and looked at the presence of measles antibodies. The background on this is that most infants in most countries receive their first measles vaccine at 12 to 15 months of age. And previously, it was thought that the maternal antibodies that crossed the placenta were protective in these children until they got that first measles vaccination. In light of all this measles outbreak that's going on worldwide, I think this is a really important study and one reason why I really wanted to illustrate it today. What they showed by taking a look at these blood samples was that in the first month of life, 20% of the infants had antibodies that were below the protective threshold. That increased to 92% by 3 months, and by 6 months, all infants had titers that were below the protective threshold if they were exposed to measles. That's, of course, a huge problem. It totally blows out of the water the idea that these maternal antibodies are protective. They note in the paper that the majority of women who had given birth in this study had also received an immunization, that there are fewer antibodies that are produced as a result, and also when there's wild-type or naturally occurring measles circulating around, that acts as a booster. And we don't really see that very often anymore since measles supposedly was eliminated. So this presents a real danger for these infants.
You're right. It's not that the antibodies aren't protective. It's that the mothers have fewer antibodies because, as you mentioned, measles is not circulating endemically. This study was really important, as you mentioned, because it does challenge the concept that children are immunized by maternal antibodies until they get their vaccination. Now, what does this mean? What about children, therefore, that are exposed to measles? Well, there are a couple things. One is we can measure their antibodies to see whether they have adequate antibodies to protect them. And for those that aren't, we can actually provide them immunoglobulin. That is, vaccinating earlier is probably not the right answer because children don't develop a robust immune response if they're vaccinated too early. The most important thing is to make sure that measles is not circulating. So to make sure that all appropriate people are immunized so we can get herd immunity will be important to protecting kids as well.
And of course, they note in here that younger children are among the most susceptible to the infection, having high rates of complications, hospitalizations, and death subsequent to measles infection.
And those complications include things like pneumonia and encephalitis. The most vulnerable populations are the older individuals, the elderly, and the very young as well. For all individuals that aren't up to date with regard to the measles vaccination, they need to be. And for children that are exposed, we can't assume that maternal antibodies are protective.
And I would just note one final thing, and that's for parents of brand new infants. Recently, it's come to my attention that some of these parents are strategizing to ask people who will be exposed to their infants, hey, are you up to date on your vaccines? And I would offer that as one potential thing to do here.
Absolutely.
Okay, which of yours would you like to turn to?
Let's go to the life expectancy mortality rates in the United States. I build it as over the last 60 years. It's actually over the last 58 years. And this gives us an opportunity to review the history of changes in the U.S. life expectancy and mortality rates. And what they noticed is that over that period, the U.S. life expectancy seemed to increase from about 70 years to almost 80 years. It seemed to increase most dramatically between 1969 and 1979. Then it began to level off. It plateaued around 2010. And then over the last 3 years, the life expectancy has actually decreased almost half a year. And that's been primarily because adults aged 25 to 64, their mortality has actually increased as a result of drug overdoses, alcohol abuse, suicides, and also a diverse list of organ system diseases like liver disease. And it's been geographically most prominent in New England and also in the Ohio Valley. When you look at other economically advanced countries, their life expectancy continues to increase.
Well, if you were going to kind of hone in on a couple of things that might be able to be implemented fairly quickly, what would you say?
This is multifactorial. When you look at the cause-specific reasons for mortality, about 35 of those different causes have an increase in that middle age group. The opioid epidemic and synthetic opioids has been a real problem. Addressing behavioral and mental health issues is a problem. Obesity has been a problem. Hypertension has been a problem. The socioeconomic determinants of health have been issues. Stress, decreased finances, increased rent, problems with employment. This is a societal issue that's going to cause us to address it in multiple different ways. And we need to address it in youngsters so that it becomes a part of their way of life in middle age.
Very good. I'm sure we're going to hear more about this one. Let's turn now to a journal we've never talked about before, the American Chemical Society's Omega Journal. And this is a study that's got this wonderful nerdy name, smartphone-based paper, microfluidic particulometry or particulometry of norovirus from environmental water samples at the single copy level. Yikes, that's really crazy. What's the upshot of this one? For me, the upshot is that they've developed a method that's cheap, that employs a smartphone, and that can detect an incredibly small number of noroviruses. And we know that noroviruses are really not any fun at all. They're incredibly infectious when only just a very few of these particles are around. They contaminate surfaces, so they're easy for people to pick up. We hear a lot about them infecting people on cruise ships, but there are certainly other places where they can also be found and that they can cause this profound diarrhea. They developed this, as I said, really inexpensive method using a smartphone and antibodies that fluoresce so that they can take a look at, well, okay, do we see this norovirus or don't we? The advantages to it, it's lightweight, it's easy to fabricate. They use a wax printing in order to do it. There's a spontaneous flow that's induced to run these particles so that they adhere, that's capillary action, so they don't have to do anything to it to make it work. I love this. Because previously they've had to do all kinds of expensive and time-intensive and PCR-based methods in order to amplify the number of viral particles or the DNA or the RNA that could be detected. And in this case, this is just so simple. They could say, yep, it's here.
And I agree. When you picked this out, I thought, we've never talked about this journal before. Norovirus is one of the most common causes of epidemic and sporadic gastroenteritis around the world. So detecting it in water sources is incredibly important. And as you mentioned, it's very infectious. And it requires so few particles. By usual methods, we can't detect it. Usually you have to either concentrate the virus or you have to amplify the genome. And that's very difficult to do in the field. It's difficult because many countries don't have access to it. Then also exposes the personnel to the norovirus as well. This is fluorescent antibodies. The fluorescent means it has a color. The iPhone can pick up the color and count it using a special LED microscope. And with that, voila, you can test in the field. So this is pretty interesting, especially for our nerds. Also may have application to other viral detection methods as well.
Yeah, indeed. And in fact, they demonstrated the specificity of this by using Zika virus as the comparator and were able to show that they did detect the norovirus. It was very sensitive and specific. The other thing I liked about this was they did it in spiked tap water and in reclaimed wastewater. So they did simulate the field conditions also.
Absolutely. And they compared it to the usual methods of detection. It didn't do as well, by the way, in chlorinated water because the chlorine seemed to interfere with stuff. So if you do it in that particular medium, then you need to wait for the chlorine to burn off. But overall, in real world settings, it was pretty neat.
I think so. And they might be able to use this when they're trying to evaluate ships for whether people can get back on them. Let's go to your final one. That's in the New England Journal of Medicine.
This has to do with the diagnosis of blood clots to the lung, also called pulmonary embolism. Typically done two ways. The gold standard, if you suspect someone has a pulmonary embolism, is to do a CT scan. The vast majority of individuals that present with some of the classic symptoms really don't have pulmonary embolism, so we'd be using CT scan unnecessarily on everybody. So what do? We use what's called the Wells criteria based upon clinical symptoms and signs. We say, what is the probability? And then we measure a blood test called a D-dimer. A D-dimer means when a clot forms and it begins to break up, these D-dimers are released into the bloodstream. So it's a sign that a clot has formed. We use the combination of those to ascertain whether someone's low, moderate, or high probability having a pulmonary embolism. And using our current criteria, if you have a low probability and your D-dimer is less than 500, we say you don't need a CT scan, but that's only about 30% of individuals. So we're still doing a CT scan on 70% of individuals, most of whom don't have a pulmonary embolism or PE. So what this study did is they did two things. They said, listen, let's try to expand the number of patients we can exclude pulmonary embolism. Let's double the criteria for D-dimer. Instead of saying a level of 500 or less, let's use 1,000 or less if you have a low probability based upon the clinical signs and symptoms. And let's take those with a moderate probability and those that have a D-dimer of less than 500. Let's see whether we can exclude PE in those individuals. So in this prospective study, that over 2,000 patients were evaluated. About a 7% had pulmonary embolism. With the new criteria, of the over 1,325 patients who had a low or moderate probability and the D-dimers I mentioned, none of them had a blood clot in their leg. Zero out of 1,325 individuals. And by the way, they decreased the use of this CT scan from about 50% to about 34%.
Wait a sec. You said did not have a blood clot in their leg. So help me to understand that. I don't understand about the blood clot in the leg versus the blood clots in the lungs.
Most blood clots in the lung start or occur from blood clots in the legs. And by the way, we can measure those by doing a venous plethysmography. That is a sonogram that doesn't require any radiation. So it's a surrogate measure. So rather than doing a CT scan on everybody, what they did is they determined that you have a low risk of a pulmonary embolism based upon the criteria mentioned. Let's just confirm that that individual doesn't have a blood clot in the leg as a surrogate way. And that way we can avoid the radiation.
Okay. Well, this is, of course, really good because we know that the consequences of pulmonary embolism can be very dire.
Absolutely. And we mitigate those by giving people blood thinners. We only want to give those to individuals that actually need them. And these new criteria suggest we can expand those criteria to avoid doing CT scans and avoid giving blood thinners unnecessarily to a large swath of the population.
We like that. It's always best when we can do less. On that note then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.